Podcast. My name is Ben Stone, and today's podcast, I have a very special guest, Glenn Tate. He's the author of a new book series that's coming up, and I believe that's going to be hitting the shelves within a couple weeks. And the name of the book is 299 Days. Glenn, thanks very much for coming on the podcast with me, and welcome to BadQuaker.com.
Well, thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me. I've been listening to Bad Quaker since episode one, if I recall. So I feel pretty good about that. I haven't caught every episode, I admit that, but I remember episode one, and I remember a lot of enthusiasm on your part that you were taking off and doing a podcast, and it's gone very well. So congratulations.
Well, thank you, and it was from support from people like you and the others that were with me right from the beginning that made this all possible too. And I've known Glenn now for, my goodness, about 4 years or so.
That's right.
We bumped into each other over at the Survival Podcast Forum, which is a great place to learn about almost anything. I mean, like almost anything. Any topic you can think of is being discussed there. As long as it's, you know, G or PG rated, there's some pretty strict guidelines that the moderators stick with. But that's where I met Glenn, and Glenn has been going through massive changes in his life to get to the point of where he's at today. Glenn, why don't you take off and tell us about your book?
Well, thanks. The book is 299 Days, as you mentioned, and it's a prepper novel series. It's a 10-book series. And by prepper, I'm sure that all your listeners know what that means. People who are preparing for, I don't know, a collapse of the state, perhaps. Or it could be something as less dramatic as a natural disaster, but preparing for the normal things that operate to not operate. And the story is largely autobiographical. The main character is me. And this main character realizes a need to prepare because he looks around, as I did, and sees all kinds of crazy things like just-in-time inventory where a supermarket only has a few days' worth of food and that sort of thing, and thinks, my goodness, if diesel fuel became scarce, these shelves would be empty very quickly, and starts thinking through these things. The other thing that gets this guy, and the main character is Grant Mattson, the thing that gets Grant prepping also is his job. I, in real life, have a job that gives me a front row seat to corruption. I live in the state capital of Washington State, and I have a job that allows me to see things that other people don't get to see. And I don't want to exaggerate. I don't see full-on criminal corruption. I don't see money changing hands or anything like that. I don't mean to exaggerate. It's the soft corruption of things not working as they should, things not working in my opinion, in a constitutional way, and that sort of thing. And so this guy sees bad things coming, and he knows how a collapse will come because he sees it at work. He's in the conference room when discussions go on about things like how incredibly unsustainable it is for the state to spend the amount of money it does and to take it from people and all of those other things. I think people reading this will look at the description of how the collapse is coming. It's underway, in my opinion, and they can look at it and look at current events and say, oh my goodness, yeah, that is going on. So this guy preps. His wife is not understanding of this, not a bad person by any means, but just doesn't see the necessity to do it because in her upbringing, in her way of life, and this applies to millions and millions of Americans, nothing bad has ever happened. Why would you be worried about civil unrest, for example? I mean, that only happened in LA that one time, and there was a flood or something in Louisiana, and that just happens, you know, on rare occasions. Why would you worry about this? So he prepares. There's this struggle to bring her along. There's an event. I'm trying not to spoil plot. There's an event, and that kind of culminates this whole thing, and it becomes apparent that things are not going well and that it's time to leave. He goes out to his cabin, and from there I'm going to get very, very vague, and there's a visitor out at the cabin, and there's a group that forms out there. The community around the cabin builds up and governs itself without any outside influence. Oh my goodness, is that even possible? people getting along and doing things for their mutual benefit without the government telling them to do it? I mean, is that even possible? So that happens. And then, again, being vague about the plot, there's some good guys. I call them patriots. And there's some bad guys. I call them loyalists. And the patriots and the loyalists go at it. And there's a bit of an ending, and then the state of Washington is put on a different path. And so I've just described 3,200 pages in about a minute and a half, so you can imagine there's some blanks that have been left out, but that's the essence of it. One thing about this is that there's nothing kooky. There are no conspiracy theories. There's nothing this is not Revelation. I'm a person mm-hmm. of faith. I don't mean to imply that religion is a conspiracy theory or something. I'm not putting that in the kookiness category, but I'm just letting people know this is not political.
It's not a religious book. It's not necessarily a political book.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So it's more about how a collapse is unfolding, how it's going to unfold, and then what people do. It's all about people. It's seen through the eyes of, depending on how you count them, about 100 characters. Don't worry, it doesn't get all blurry and unfocused. But people, for example, confront normalcy bias. I'm sure you're familiar with that, and that's where people mm-hmm. in a crisis look back to what's normal, and they try to shoehorn in normal into their circumstances. An example of that is during the civil unrest, there's gunfire in the background, there's sirens going on. I mean, the place is melting down. There are no police of any kind because the government's run out of money. Huh, who saw that coming? And and there's a guy washing his, his 1969 Mustang. And he's in a trance almost. He can't relate to what's going on. He can't process all that's happening. All he knows is that years and years ago, he used to ride around in this Mustang, and those were the years of his life. And he just sits there and you know, bad things come upon him. And that's an example of normalcy bias, but it's told through characters and resistance to change. The other thing that's told through characters is the other side of the coin. You and I are largely on the same page when it comes to our worldview, and there are many, many others, about 308 out of 309 million in this country, pardon me, who either love the government or tolerate the government or accept the government at the levels it currently is. And I tell stories through their eyes. There are several characters who live in the big cities and love to be taken care of by government. One of them in the book is my sister, for example. And so I'm not making up, you know, bad guys, evil villains or something like that. These are believable, relatable people. And they describe through their eyes how there are these mean teabaggers who are trying to, you know, take over the country, and they're all right-wing haters and all of this other stuff. Why don't they just let the government do what it needs to do? Because down in Venezuela, things go really, really well, and that's the new model here. And why would anyone resist that? So you see it from all kinds of different perspectives. And there are plenty of perspectives in the middle, too. There are some people who start off rallying behind the government because there's a crisis, and then they start thinking about it, and they see that this crisis is being used to do some bad things, and they start to change their minds. So it's not a comic book where there are super good guys and super bad guys. I don't like that kind of stuff, and I don't think it's real. This is a real depiction of things that haven't happened yet, so I'm not sure how I can say it's real, but it's a realistic depiction of things mm-hmm. that I think are going to happen, and I can explain why I think they're going to happen.
You mentioned one word there that I wanted to do some clarification on, because there's a lot of confusion about that word, patriot. Now, the word patriot actually is from the same root as we get paternal and a patriarchal. It literally means to protect your own family. And then the extension of that is to protect those that are around your family, your community. And a lot of people get confused between what's a patriot and what's maybe a nationalist or a person who is committed to a government, to protecting and working for a government. That's not a patriot. You know, the patriots that we think of from the War of Independence, if they had been faithful to their government, they would have been fighting against guys like George Washington.
Right, and I'm glad you bring that up, because I'm just using typical, you know, layperson terms, patriot and loyalist. A lot of it comes from the War of Independence, otherwise known as the Revolutionary War. But you're right. If the root of the word means protecting your family and those around you, protecting your group, then I think that applies very well, because what happens at this community, and this community is centered around the cabin where the main character bugs out to, is exactly that. I talk about gangs in the book, and when you think of the term gang, you think of motorcycle gangs, you think of ethnic gangs, you think of bad criminals who are often different than the person who's thinking about them. I'm not, you know, a Hell's Angels, for example, kind of guy. So to me, a gang is something that's different. Well, not really, because what gangs are, good or bad, they are groups of people who are coming together. There's exclusive membership, and they protect their own. They take care of their own people in a material sense, and they are against people that are out to get them. They might form alliances. That's what gangs do. Well, guess what? When there's no gigantic government, people in this country are going to do what people have done in virtually every other country and in virtually every other time in the past, and that's come together. You might call them tribes, you might call them extended families, you might call them religious sects, you might call them a military unit, you might call them a neighborhood. They go by various names, but people turn into gangs. Many gangs are good gangs. The characters in the book, there's a team of guys who I shoot with and you know have prepped with, and they become a good gang. They're rather aggressive. They're 25-year-old men, and that tends to happen. But out protecting people, protecting the community, doing good things. So there are good gangs, and then of course there are all kinds of depictions of bad gangs. Well, they're government gangs. There's something called the Freedom Corps that I write about. By the way, a few months after I came up with the term Freedom Corps for sort of the Hugo Chavez, Red Beret kind of thug people, by the way, FEMA came out with something. They have a new thing, and I call them the F Corps for Freedom Corps. You can imagine the double meaning of F. FEMA came out with something, and they've come up with the FEMA Corps. So now there's a real live Homeland Security F Corps. It's going to help in disasters, of course, Ben. And so, there's the F Corps, which are bad gangs. Some police units act as bad gangs. I'll be very candid with you. There are plenty of police in this story who quit or retire and end up doing good things. So, you know, it's not all, you know, black and white in that sense, but they're bad gangs. And then there's something I call the Rotary Club gangs in the book. And those are the soft criminals. They're not as brutal and violent as some of the other traditional gangs. But I describe, for example, a dentist who is treating people. Well, of course, there's nationalized health care in the future, and that was a bold prediction on my part. And and so the usual way of paying, the normal way, the legal, legitimate way of paying for medicine with this nationalized health care system doesn't work, because there's no money, there's no government, blah, blah, blah. So this dentist needs to be paid in cash or ammunition or gold or other things. I'll let you use your imagination. Mm-hmm. And when he doesn't get paid, he has to have people go out and collect. And there's a Russian mafia that goes and collects. So that's what I mean by the Rotary Club gangs. Another example of Rotary Club gangs, and this is how I think things are going to operate, is there are gang gas stations, and it's not run by Hell's Angels kinds of gangs. It's run by some very tough businessmen, which is the Russian word for gangster, by the way, for real. Mm-hmm. And you pay for your gas, and you don't pump more than you're supposed to. And if you act up or you do something you shouldn't do, you know, you're beaten, sort of thing. So there's that kind of Rotary Club gang. So when I say patriot, I mean groups of people coming together, taking care of their own self-interest, but not always being bad guys. While there are indeed some bad guys, there are good gangs going after bad gangs, basically. But I don't mean to exaggerate. It's not gang warfare. This is not some cheesy sort of, I don't know, HBO series about Gangland USA or whatever that is. But it's not gang warfare, but people congregate into gangs, which they do all over the world, and they have historically throughout all time. It's often how human beings operate when there isn't a gigantic government to do things for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you were describing there, both for good and for bad. And that's, you know, the tendency is according to the people and also according to their circumstances. You know, things don't always turn flowery and so forth. You have to sometimes be prepared for the worst situations. And that's kind of what separates your character from some of the people that are around him that weren't preparing for it.
Exactly. A lot of preparing for what's coming is mental preparation. You need to have your head in the game. You need to understand what's going to happen, what could happen, and how to react to it. You need to get rid of that normalcy bias. And that's one of the things I've been particularly good at doing. I come from a background that was less than pleasant, and I understand what violence is. I understand what being poor is. I understand all those sorts of things. And I feel like this misfit in this society of people that have just had everything work well for them. The electricity's always on. 911 always responds in 45 seconds and that sort of thing. And I just can't really relate to that. But then when the world turns upside down, my vision of how things go seems to be playing out. And then people, for the first time, say, hey, you were the guy that carried a concealed handgun. You know, why? Maybe I ought to listen to what you have to say. So there's some of that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I want to jump back to something you said, too. In your description of how this all comes about, you didn't rely on any kind of easy tools like, a nuclear attack or anything like that, or a giant hurricane that whips across the country and takes out everything. You just basically laid things out. If they continue like they are today, which in all likelihood they will, this is almost, we're almost guaranteed that something like this is going to happen, and it won't require a meteor hit or something.
Exactly right. One of the reasons I think this book was picked up by a publisher, it's published by that's a tongue twister, isn't it? It's published by Prepper Press. There we go. Published by Prepper Press, is that this is the only book I know of. This is the only book I know of that talks about a partial collapse. And a partial collapse is exactly what you were talking about. If things continue on the path they're going, fiscally, politically, socially to an extent, that bad things are going to happen. It does not require an electromagnetic pulse, an EMP, or a meteor, or anything else. Every other prepper book I know of, everything else is this the first couple sentences of the story are, and there was an EMP and all the electricity went off. Anyway, let's talk about the characters. Let's talk about gunfights. Wait a minute. A lot of this book, especially books 1 and 2 of the 10, talk about exactly how things are happening now and how they're going to unfold. And so people that read 299 Days will get a very good insight into what's going on currently and what's probably going to go on and how things will unfold. And that helps them when it comes to that part of prepping, which is having your head in the game. They will be expecting things that other people won't. For example, the F Corps. You know, I write about it in a fictional sense about the Freedom Corps. Ding, ding, ding. FEMA's come up with the FEMA Corps. So there's something that you won't be surprised about when maybe the FEMA Corps is unveiled as the more dark and sinister thing than what it currently is being described. So there's that a partial collapse. The utilities stay on in my book, which is sort of not done in prepper fiction. I mean, of course the electricity goes off. Of course the water goes off. And by the way, that could happen for all I know. You know, there's a lot of weaknesses in the grid. By the way, the electrical grid goes on and off for a period of time for a very interesting reason, but stays on for an even more interesting reason. And that, I think, makes this novel series entirely different than every other one. And so that's one of the reasons I think it was picked up by a publisher. You might wonder how I wrote a 3,200-page novel series that got published. The answer is, I don't know. It's a mystery to me, too. It's an amazing feat that this thing was picked up. And by the way, the editors at Prepper Press are amazing. They're unicorns. They do wonderful, wonderful things. And they turned what was, I think, a pretty good draft into an amazing, very readable novel. So there you go. A guy who has no writing experience has an idea and sits down and works for 2.5 years and writes it out. And now we're talking about a book release. Isn't that amazing?
That's crazy. We're going to break here, and I'm going to save this file, so in case anything happens, we'll have it. And when we come back from the break, I'm going to continue talking with Glenn Tate, the author of 299 Days, a book that you're going to want to get your hands on. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge. Real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site. All the courses, plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help keep badquaker.com on the internet. Thank you very much. Thanks for sticking with me through the commercial, and I'm back with Glenn Tate, the author of 299 Days. And like I said before the break, you're going to want to get your hands on this book. Glenn, when is it going to be available for him?
September 1st. It'll be available on Amazon in Kindle and hard copy format. We have a website where you can sign up and get bonus chapters, which are free chapters, little side stories that are not in the book. And if you give us your email address, we will also send you on September 1st a link. We're so helpful. We want to help people. Here's a link about how to buy the book. And so that's on the
little reminder.
Yeah, that's on the homepage of 299days.com. By the way, give us a fake name. We don't sell email addresses. We don't give them away. You know, we don't play that game. I mean, by the way, I don't know how valuable an email list of preppers would be, because we're out there trying to buy as little as possible, right? We're not exactly the golden consumers who buy things we can't afford with credit cards. So we're not exactly a giant marketing group.
Yeah, unless you're marketing Mountain House dry goods.
Which has a gigantic back order, apparently, and you can't actually get it, as I understand it. So there you go.
I think a lot of people are really catching on to the fact that the system is not quite as stable as, you know, as it's made out to be. You were talking about just-in-time inventory. And let's hit that for a second, because I think most people have no idea what just-in-time inventory is.
Yeah, I think just-in-time inventory is going to be one of these phrases that we look back in a few years and we say, oh my goodness, did we really do that? Sort of like segregation and other things. You look back and you say, did people really think that was a good idea? I'm not equating just-in-time inventory to segregation, but as far as the level of bad idea-ness goes, it's right up there. What just-in-time inventory is that stores, and we're talking supermarkets, not just convenience stores, we're talking supermarkets, we're talking
hospitals,
frighteningly enough, Lowe's, yeah. Home Depot, the military.
Pharmacies.
Oh, pharmacies. That's depicted a lot. There's a lot of discussion about people running out of various medicines and what happens. That's going to be a big, big, big problem. The percentage of people in this country that depend on medicines of some kind is very, very large, and a lot of people, unfortunately, in this collapse are going to die because of that. But anyway, so it's just keeping enough inventory so that you've got a day or two or three, and the amount of time varies, but you've got just a little bit of inventory. The just-in-time inventory phrase means that the new inventory, the resupply, comes just in time. So, for example, every 2 to 3 days, they run out of Doritos at your supermarket, and mm-hmm. and a semi truck comes from probably, I'm in Western Washington, it probably comes from the Los Angeles area. What is that? 1,000 miles, burning up all that diesel fuel, mm-hmm. and you've got to have a clear, open highway that's not closed off and doesn't have any snipers on overpasses, for example. So you've got this unusually peaceful set of circumstances, thousands of gallons of diesel and complete calm and peace. And so that semi-truck goes up I-5 and comes to Western Washington and hands off enough Doritos to supply that grocery store for a few days. If the truck quits rolling for whatever reason, or the internet goes down, or the internet is spotty and unreliable, and that's how the reordering is done with the UPC codes and all the computer inventorying, then you're not going to get anything resupplying at the supermarket. And people go to a supermarket. There's a scene described in the book where this revelation came to me. And you think of a supermarket as a really big place, and it is a really big place. I mean, it's a lot of square feet. And you think, well, they've got a lot of food back there. Well, what I did one time was I walked on a lark because I was thinking about this because I'm a crazy person and all I think about is like how I'm going to live for the next few years, you know, which is a silly, silly thought, I guess. But anyway, I go to the back of the supermarket and I see all these semi-trucks and all these semi-truck bays. And I watch as they keep rolling in, and only in a matter of a few minutes, you saw quite a few of them. They roll in, they back up, they drop pallets off, and then they take off. And there are different pallets of different things. You know, it's not like there's a semi full of Doritos. You know, well, 1/16 of the semi might be Doritos. And I thought, did these just – and I see a California license plate on this truck, and I'm thinking, did this just really come from L.A.? Well, it really did. So that's just-in-time inventory. Why do businesses do it? They save money on storage space. They don't have to pay for inventory. There's, you know, interest charges on that sort of thing because everything's mm-hmm. done with debt, of course. We don't do anything with money. We do it all with debt, which is a problem.
And inventory is taxed.
Oh, of course. Of course. We need to create a disincentive for stores to have stuff that people need. That's brilliant. And so so that's why this has happened, and it is endemic. There is virtually no industry or product that I can think of that is not subject to just-in-time inventory. This also applies to the military. Now, the military has better stores and all of that. They're not as dependent, but spare parts for things like whiz-bang helicopters and things like that, that are mm-hmm. remarkably effective at what they do and for which there is little or no defense. Well, if a part doesn't come, a 35-cent part, and they've gone through the ones they've got stored up, which are not too many, then that helicopter doesn't fly. That becomes important in the later series of books in which there is a military conflict between the Patriots and the Loyalists. And without giving much away, people might wonder how could a small group of patriots who are completely underarmed compared to the government that's a paper tiger, how could they pull off a win? And the answer is that 35-cent part means that helicopter is staying on the ground and that helicopter crew has abandoned the base because they're not getting paid and they don't really think it's a good idea to go shoot up a bunch of Americans. And so that's how the equalization occurs in a military sense. So that's just-in-time inventory. And, you know, look at the news. And don't believe me. Don't believe Ben Stone. Look at the news. There's an ice storm. There's a windstorm. And it doesn't have to be a cataclysmic Katrina kind of thing. There's just a little hiccup. And it's not even in your part of the country. Right now in Western Washington, it's about 70 degrees. And elsewhere in the country, it's very, very hot. If if it's hot in LA and a couple transformers blow, there's no refrigeration for a food distribution center, which means for a day or two, they're scrambling to find another supply place to send all that frozen hamburger, I guess. And so, I mean, little teeny things can disrupt this system. And you see it every day if you look at current events. And so that's what just-in-time inventory is. And it's a big reason why this collapse is going to be a very big problem for a lot of people.
Glenn, as you know, and as many of my long-term listeners know, I spent years in the aerospace industry and in the defense industry, and specifically in the realm of aircraft engines. I have a lot of experience dealing with the inventories of parts of aircraft engines, and I can tell you that that was my first encounter with just-in-time inventory.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely bizarre. But we would be in Cincinnati, in the greater Cincinnati area, in Ohio, and our mechanics are assembling a jet engine. It's exactly the kind of a jet engine that's flying on planes all around the world, except we've made one minor modification to it so that we can test it. And we've got this one part that's coming from Turkey. It's manufactured in Turkey, and the just-in-time inventory process means that when the mechanic is ready to put that part on the engine, when he reaches for his shelf to get that part, the company, GE, who was the company I worked for, General Electric intended to have the part carrier literally placing it on his shelf within moments of when he's going to reach for it. So we would time out how long it took the mechanic to assemble the engine. And the idea was to have that part coming from Turkey into our facility, right, going straight in. We would check it in. We would make sure that all the paperwork was correct on it. It had been inspected, and put it in that mechanic's shelf within moments of when he was going to need it. Now, that meant that if anything took place between Cincinnati, Ohio, and Turkey, we get no part, and the mechanic stands there. And this is all because of cost. It costs money to have this part made ahead of time and sitting on a shelf.
Yes.
But what the idiots don't consider is how often that mechanic ends up standing there because the part's delayed or the paperwork got delayed. The part's here, but we can't give him the part because the paperwork's delayed because somebody forgot to sign a signature, maybe in Italy or somewhere. And so he sits there. So we've got the whole process shut down while the guy sits there and waits, and the mechanic's getting paid about $40 an hour, and there's nothing we can do. We have to wait, you know. And that's just on that one thing. And this is parts. I could literally look in our I started to say the software name, but it jumped out of my head. But anyway, I could look on our computers and tell exactly how many of these parts are in existence. How many are on wing? How many are sitting in airports, in engines that are sitting there as spares? And oftentimes, it was easier to wait for the part to come from Turkey than it was to get a hold of the Cincinnati airport and have them send the part across the river to Cincinnati so that we could put it on the plane.
And it's not like you could just machine your own or use something, because the FAA would flip out and say you can't possibly do that. So there you go. There's the government involvement a little bit with just-in-time inventory.
Yeah. Yeah, it was crazy. And I could see, and especially when you – because a lot of what we did was military. And when you begin to understand how many individual parts – that the military depends on, and the fact that there is no reserve on a vast majority of those parts. They're literally manufactured sometimes around on the other side of the world for the most important parts that the military, for these, what'd you call them, whiz-bang devices?
That's right, whiz-bang devices.
These almost magical planes that can, you know, practically fly through the air without sound and go do all the fantastic things that the military depends on them doing. And many people don't realize that lots of the critical parts are manufactured in India. They're manufactured in Southeast Asia in different locations. A lot of them are manufactured in Turkey. And All it takes is a slight hiccup in this whole system, and all those helicopters are sitting on the runway. All those airplanes are down. All the aircraft carriers. Take a look at the Soviet Union. Take a look at the military bases with submarines literally sitting there rusting away and slowly sinking into their harbor.
Mm-hmm. And this brings up a great point, which is the fragility of the United States economically, politically, and other ways. The government, in my book, wants to do bad things. Don't get me wrong. You and I, Ben, we don't think that government is benevolent and wonderful. There are decent people in government, obviously, but as a whole,
right.
It sort of exists to do bad things in the sense that we have in this book, where it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The more crises there are, the more government the people want to have and all of that other stuff. So the government in this book is big and bad and wants to do bad things. Guess what? They can't pull it off. Mm-hmm. That's the hope of this book. Because I think it's real. And this is not, again, comic book stuff. I don't gain anything by telling a bunch of people that everything will be all right. I'm telling people what I think is going to happen. But as the helicopter example I used illustrates, the bad guys just can't pull it off. Now, there's an initial period where things go well for the bad guys and some people lose hope. But it's not sustainable. The way things are now, and every permutation of that, is not sustainable. So the way things are now will not be how it is in the near future. And to me, that's hopeful. Now, in the interim, there's a very nasty period. Again, it's not a complete breakdown. There's not zombies. There's no cannibalism. There's nothing like that. It's a very uncomfortable and unpleasant period. I would compare what's coming to the United States as what happened to Russia in the early 90s and mm-hmm. Argentina in about 2000, and in some ways is still going on. In some ways, it could be as bad as parts of the Balkans and that sort of thing. But that was not, you know, meteor impacts, 99% of people killed thing. So that's what I foresee happening. But in the end, the government can't pull it off for some very predictable and simple reasons. And that's what people need to hear. A lot of people in our community, the Liberty community, we focus on all the bad stuff. And we should. There's bad stuff going on. You need to be informed about it, da-da-da. But you need to understand that there are very rational and clearly illustratable ways that the government cannot pull this off. And I think people need that second half of the equation, which is the hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Let's break right here, and I'll save this file, and we'll come back from the commercial break and talk more with Glenn Tate, the author of 299 Days. And this is a book series that you're going to want to get your hands on.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
And thanks for sticking with me through the commercial again. I'm back with Glenn Tate, the author of 299 Days. This is a brand new book series that's coming out in a couple weeks. And Glenn, you're releasing this in kind of an interesting format. You're putting out the first two books in the series at the same time, and then after some time, you're coming out with two more books. And I think it was really smart the way you're doing that, because it allows people to ingest this in a format that doesn't overwhelm them, and yet gives them just enough to keep them wanting more.
Yeah, and there were a few reasons to do that, and there are 10 books, and they come out in two book increments approximately every 3 months. So the first set, books 1 and 2, will be September 1st. The next set, books 3 and 4, will be approximately mid-November. All the books are written, and so this isn't one of these things where you're saying, oh, I'm going to start a series, and then some clown is spending 3 months trying to come up with another two, and he's slapping them together. Nope, that's not the situation. But mm-hmm. people can whet their appetite, have some time to ingest it, as you said. The reason for the 3-month increment instead of a 6-month increment or a year increment, which is more typical, apparently, in the publishing world. By the way, so you can imagine, I didn't know anything about how publishing books work, so I found out a lot about that. But the reason I was very adamant that we need to accelerate the schedule is that I think bad things are coming relatively quickly, and I wanted to get the whole series out in a year or so time frame. Last thing I want is for, you know, book six to be ready to be released and the United States collapses. So that's why we're doing it that way. And the reason for two books instead of one is that at 3,200 pages divided by 10, these books, if we wouldn't have broken them into 1/10 or so segments, they would have been too big, and they would cost too much to print. So we have two lower priced books, and that's how we did. And if you start with books 3, 4, you can easily go back and read 1, 2. The books are relatively standalone, but it's better to do them in a series if you can.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to, I forgot to mention this earlier, we're going to put links to on badquaker.com to Glenn's website that's about the book. And when the book becomes available, we will come back and revisit this, and we'll have Amazon links so that you can find it really easy. And we'll revisit this again and put links back to Glenn's site again.
Great. Great.
Now, we were talking during the break about something you and I actually know quite a bit about, but it might be kind of a shock to some of the audience. A lot of times people in the liberty movement, there's a great division where some people really look at the military and the police as being, you know, practically saviors, and some people demonize them as monsters. And the reality is, yes, both and neither. You know, they're human beings. They're individual human beings, and some of them are pretty bad, but some of them are really amazingly good people. And tell me, Glenn, how does your book portray that kind of situation?
It just as you described, there are good guys and bad guys, and there's lots of people in the middle. There is no simplistic formula. So some government folks are portrayed negatively and some positively. I started out, and you and I started out, we went through you didn't go through this process. Let me just describe the process I went through. And that was, I started off as thinking that the military was largely bad guys. Law enforcement was largely bad guys. And I started changing my mind as I started meeting people in those communities and getting to know them. You and I have got to know, you know, some people in common, and my mind was changed. And then I started really getting to know a couple of folks in that community, one of whom is a character in the book. His name in the book is Special Forces Ted. He is indeed a retired Special Forces soldier, and he is a member of Oath Keepers, which is a group of military and law enforcement, past and present, who say that they will honor their oath to protect and defend the United States Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. They will not follow specific orders to disarm citizens, to intern citizens, and to do things that are unconstitutional. And so they're the good guys. And I talked to Ted and to law enforcement folks. One of the other big characters in the book is based on a real person who's a friend of mine, who is a police officer who exposed corruption, or tried to, in his department and was fired. And so I get those viewpoints too, but he's a very good person, and he would not allow bad people to do bad things to people. And so through Special Forces Ted, and the character in the book is named Rich Gentry, between those two characters, you see Oath Keeper sorts of people doing decent things. And my mind was changed by this. And so I've come through that process. So I think that a lot of your listeners who have a generally negative view of military and law enforcement might see some things in here that might change their minds. I'm not trying to change minds. Believe me, this is not a persuasion piece. I mean, if you write 3,200 pages and are trying to persuade somebody of some gigantic change in their worldview, you know, you're doomed for failure. So I'm not trying to do that. But I think people will find it interesting that there's nuance and complexity to all of this. There are some characters, one law enforcement character in particular, who starts off rallying behind the government and doing what he's told and doing criminal things. And he has a change of heart in a pretty dramatic way, I'll put it that way. So that's how I portray this, because it's based on real live people. This is not comic book stuff.
Now, I don't want to expose you know, any of your private life or your private details or anything like that, but I do want to emphasize the fact that I've known you quite some time now, and I know what you do in real life. I know your real life job, and I know I can verify for my listeners that when you write about these things or when you talk about these things happening in the depths of government and behind the scenes and so forth, you know exactly what you're talking about. You have seen this. You have experienced it firsthand.
Yeah, that's true, and I appreciate you not giving much away. The fact that a friend of mine is a police officer who tried to expose corruption and was fired should say it all. One of the things, to give people some idea about my credibility, for lack of a better term, and this has been on the Survival Podcast forum, so this is no secret. The past two governor's inaugural balls, I've been invited to and have attended. I have a tuxedo, and I for my day job, I need to do that, and I'm there, and I'm pleasant, and I eat hors d'oeuvres, and the whole time I'm thinking, I really don't like what you people are doing. So there you go. And there's some scenes, one in particular, in which there's a discussion, a political and economic discussion, in a conference room at the governor's office. I think people will read that and understand that either I was there or some people I know were there, and I won't tell you which it was, or it might be both. You don't know, do you?
Yeah.
And so you're going to see things that you're not normally going to see. And I want to be very, very clear and not exaggerate. I am not a, you know, super secret spy guy. I'm not, you know, a Homeland Security guy, nothing like that. It's what I do for a living would actually be rather boring. It's just the things I get to see. So that's
right.
Important. I don't want to exaggerate.
And well, I will add, though, that at those inaugural balls, you are not serving hors d'oeuvres. You are being served.
Well, yeah, that's right. And somebody else paid for it, and that's too bad. But it's part of the job, so at least I'm honest. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I appreciate the insights that you've given me over the years to allow me to understand really what's happening inside and really good to get a ground-level perspective of, you know, of how things work on the inside like that. You and I have talked quite a few times about how you know, you mentioned the soft corruption, and I think what most people don't really understand is that soft corruption is endemic. It's not just the senator, it's not just the congressman, you know, getting some kind of an advantage from some lobbyist somewhere. This is down on city governments of small towns where of a couple thousand people, and there are ways that, you know, their cousin gets a contract that nobody else finds out about, and, you know, certain streets get taken care of in different ways, and advantages are passed around like that. And this is endemic through the whole system from top to bottom.
Exactly right. I have a definition for corruption I'm working on. I'm going to try it on you and see what your listeners think about it. And it's an unorthodox definition of corruption. To me, corruption is not bags of money trading hands. That happens, I guess. I've never seen it, but whatever. I guess it happens. To me, corruption is when you're astounded, absolutely amazed that the right thing happened, that the law was followed, that people were decent, that government employees did their jobs. I think a lot of the soft corruption I'm talking about is just pure laziness or being overwhelmed. There are some government workers who work very, very hard. I know some of them. And they just have a million things that they're supposed to do, and they can't possibly be that check on that other agency or that other person in their agency that's doing bad things. I know that judges, for example, cannot possibly read all the materials that are submitted to them, let alone, you know, analyze them and all of that. And so that's when you're astounded, when the right thing happens. I had a friend who had a case. She's a lawyer. It was decided in her favor, and it was against government, and it was handed down by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a pretty serious federal court. And she was so surprised that she won that her first reaction was to call the Court of Appeals, because she thought the order that was handed down that said she won, she thought it was a typo. She couldn't believe it. Now, that's corruption. Now, are the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, are they being bribed? No, I don't think so. I certainly have no evidence of that, and would surprise me, honestly, if they were. But that's what corruption is, when the whole system is just held together with baling wire and duct tape and nothing works and people just slough on through. That's what I'm talking about soft corruption.
There's a, I'm not going to rehash an old podcast fight that my listeners, probably many of them, know about, but you probably are not familiar with. But there's a personality doing there's a person doing podcasts who has what I consider a trick that he pulls on judges when they do when they've got somebody in front of them who was maybe rolled through a stop sign or was doing, you know, 65 in a 60 zone or whatever. And there's a series of little verbal tricks that he plays to get cases like that thrown out of court. And there are a lot of people that just practically think he's magic. But my argument is, no, the courts just don't want to deal with that. They'd rather just throw out something than have to actually put effort into it. Am I being way off on that?
No, that's exactly right. I can relate. I got a speeding ticket a few months ago, and so I was in whatever it is, municipal court or something like that, and I thought I had some, you know, reasons why I wasn't guilty, and guess what? There was no prosecutor there because it's a revenue court. It's just to generate money. They're not actually going to try cases, and I had this particular, I don't know what you call it, I guess objection or something like that. And I said to the judge, I note that there is no one from the city here to oppose it. So I think I win. And the judge smiled, and yes, indeed I did. See, the prosecutors don't even show up. There's too much stuff to do. So yes, I think you're on to something. Is that corrupt in the sense of people being bribed? Absolutely not. Is it corrupt in the sense that there's something that's been introduced into a system that is bad for the system, which is, I believe, what the word corruption means, like you corrupt a sterile saline solution or something like that. That, I think, is exactly what it is, because it's this high-volume revenue court, and it's not really about whether I was speeding or even if my objection to the ticket was actually well-founded. It had nothing to do with that.
Precisely.
Exactly, yeah. So I think you're exactly right.
Yeah, I think that's really, you know, more cases than people realize go that way. It's like, well, what's the path of least resistance here? How can I get out of this? The judge is thinking this. How can I get out of this chair that I'm sitting in, go to lunch, come back, finish my job? The judge is no different than, you know, anybody else. He's just doing a job. And our tendency, since there's very little reward or punishment once you get into a position like that, our tendency, all of us humans, is to do the minimal, except for a few of us who are freaks who like to, you know, overachieve. But the vast majority of humans like to do the minimal amount and just get by.
And that's why I think that when people look at bad things that happen in government and they immediately personalize it and they think that a particular person is evil, it could be true, but more likely than not, what is Occam's razor, that the most common explanation, or the most likely explanation, is the simplest. I think you're exactly right, that it's just people punching the time clock and doing what they can get away with and the least amount of effort. And I see that a lot in what I do. And that's why in the book, I don't personalize the bad guys. There are some very evil people. There are some people I've met in government who I think are downright evil, and and they're described. One in particular is described, and the folks who have read the early versions of this book have all come back and said, that Nancy Ringman seems like a very bad person. And I say, you ought to see the real live version. but so there is some of that. But yeah, you're right. It's more complicated and more simple at the same time, the badness that's going on.
My good friend over at the Freedom Fiends podcast, Michael W. Dean, he says, I've heard him say this a few times lately, that the government is kind of like a big, dumb dinosaur that's so stupid it's eating its own tail and doesn't realize it.
Exactly.
And I've always thought, you know, that's not a realistic idea of dinosaurs, but it certainly does match the government.
No, exactly right. Exactly right. And that's why I think government is failing, and why it ultimately will fail. And when the failure happens, it'll be pretty dramatic. But it's still fixable, because a dinosaur is an unnatural thing, at least in the current mm-hmm. setting, I guess. And certainly an animal eating its own tail is an unnatural thing. And so it can't go on. We can't have dinosaurs eating their own tails and think, oh, okay, this is the way it's always been and the way it will always be. And that's what the book is about. Here's a depiction of a dinosaur eating its own tail. Boy, that's crazy. That can't go on. Oh, by the way, in the future, there will be no dinosaurs and they won't be eating their tails.
Well, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left in the podcast. I've asked this of my last couple of guests, and I don't expect you to answer it with exactly, you know, the way I would answer it. So I'm just allowing you to express how you see the distant future. I'm talking about the current government that, as we know it, is doomed. I'm pretty sure of that. And it will do something like what the Soviet Union did at some point in time, or maybe worse. But what do you see coming out on the far end of the other side of this, maybe even beyond the 10-book series? Because let me just set you up further. Because I think there's going to be some kind of there'll be some kind of a major change, but there'll be government on the other side eventually coming out of this. Now go ahead and tell me what you think about that.
Yeah, I see a variety of outcomes. I see outcomes depending on the region of the country you're in. I could see places like the northeastern United States and the large cities continuing to do the dumb stuff that they're doing, and they seem to be a masochist and enjoy living under these utopian semi-socialist regimes. And so knock yourselves out, enjoy the utopia that you all have created, you know, just we'll put up a big fence so you can't come and eat all the food out in the rural areas, that sort of thing. I see the United States disintegrating as a 50-state entity of 309 million people. That's way too big to have a republic. It can't be done. I see southern states not breaking off in a civil war setting where you've got blue armies and gray armies and it's all dramatic and all of that other stuff. I see southern states and the mountain western states just kind of stopping being part of the federal system. When the EPA says you can't do this, I can see, and this is depicted in the book, Texas state officials saying, you know what, why don't you guys just go back to D.C. and nobody shoots anybody. You know, it's just kind of an unraveling. I think the rural mm-hmm. areas will be largely self-governing. They'll do the things that people need to do collectively. Oh, my goodness, the word collectivism on the on Bad Quaker, right? That's crazy. No, there are collective things. I think security mm-hmm. being one of them. Yeah. A very simple court system. This is all depicted in the book. The community comes together and does the things that really need to be done and not the goofy stuff like the EPA. And I see a lot of that happening. So it'll vary based on region, but we'll look back at a picture of 50 stars on an American flag, and it'll look very old fashioned and very weird. So that's what I mm-hmm. see. And I see very bad things in some bad places and very good things in some good places and many, many gradations in between. And so it'll be complicated. And people will migrate to the places that are good. People, and I talk about this in the book, people will go to Chicago, or in the book I talk about Seattle, which is the big city where all the badness is going on. They will willingly go there because they want to mm-hmm. be taken care of. And if people go to places that mirror how they want to live, I'm okay with that. It's called the 10th Amendment, among other things. And so knock yourselves out. And so that's what I see happening long term. You and I will be in the good places doing the good things, and I'm okay with that. And everybody else, well, they made their choice. They need to live with it.
Yeah. Let's give information on the book one more time before we wrap it up. I'm talking to Glenn Tate, the author of 299 Days. It's a new book series that's coming out. The first two books will be available September 1st at Amazon. We're going to put links at badquaker.com to Glenn's website for 299 Days. And when the books come out, we're going to revisit all this and give you guys a reminder to... Oh, and Tell them about the email thing and the reminder with that too.
Yeah, on the homepage of 299days.com, you can give us your name and email address. We'll send you bonus chapters, and we will also send you a link on September 1st that says, click here to buy our product. See, we're being so helpful and nice to people, aren't we?
Well, the little reminder, you know, because sometimes 2 weeks can go by pretty quickly.
Right, and not everybody's listening to this show the day it comes out. So you people might be listening to this after September 1st, and they can just go onto Amazon, and it's Glenn with one N, Glenn Tate, T-A-T-E, and 299 days. That'll get you where you need to go.
Glenn, you know, you're a personal friend. I've known you a long time, and I appreciate you coming on my show. I would have had you on the show even if you had not written the book, because you know, you and I can sometimes spend an hour just chatting on the phone.
Yes.
But I'm so glad to have you on the show. I'm so glad you've got this book out there, and I can't wait to see it actually, you know, real live in my hands.
Oh yeah, and it's been an amazing experience. I'm stunned and amazed. We've had private conversations about the amazingness and the coincidences that are involved, and I'll leave it at that. And it's been a wonderful thing. I hope people get a lot out of it. Hey, get it from a library. I mean, don't necessarily buy it from me. I'm not really making any money on this, and I'll probably lose my job if people found out I'm writing it. So there's very little reward compared to the risk here. Just read it, get your mind in this, understand what's coming, get prepared. Just do that. That's what I really want people to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Glenn, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ben.